I will say about my career that looking forward, there's no plan. I did this, I did that, and then I failed at this, and then I tried that. It was just like completely lurching forward to the next thing. But when I look back, it's a perfect sequence.
Mm.
But you don't see that pattern in reverse. So if you ask me to look back, that's the value of looking back, because you see the pattern and the sequence of where you got to where you got. Because looking forward, I will tell you, I didn't have a clue.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, William Ravis, the official realtor of the Arts Foundation, the Kelly Foundation, and the Cape Cod Foundation. We couldn't do it without your support. We'd like to thank Bank 5, Cape Cod 5, Cape and Islands Workforce Board, the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod. Hey there, this is Julie Wake, the Executive Director of the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Now in its fifth season, the Creative Exchange Podcast is a celebration of the artists, arts leaders, and creative minds and their artistic journeys to bring joy, offer connection, and inspire hope through their work. Through the Creative Exchange, we discover what it means to be an artist in today's world and how the arts can bridge cultures and provide positive, meaningful change across all sectors and in our lives and our local, national, and global communities. Hey everyone, welcome back. I am so excited to share this conversation with design legend Oren Sherman. He's a professor at the Rhode Island School of Design. Oren is a specialist in storytelling, branding, concept design, and entrepreneurship. He collaborates with great brands to craft engaging experiences. For over 30 years, Oren has been designing exclusive artwork for a variety of clients, including Steuben Glass, PepsiCo, Disney, the Olympics, Visa, Hermes, Mobil Oil, the U.S. Postal Service, the U.S. Mint, and many more. And just like him, Oren's work is sophisticated, contemporary, and utterly unique, standing at the cutting edge where art meets commerce. In our conversation, we talk about the importance of failures and reinvention, how to live forever, and of course, the Wizard of Oz. Please enjoy this conversation with designer and my friend, Oren Sherman. Hi, Oren. It's so great to see you in the Arts Foundation's office here in Hyannis. Welcome.
Hi, Julie.
Right before we hit record, I said to Oren, I don't even know where to begin because you've done so much in your 40-year career. Where should we begin?
Well, we can begin right at the beginning, or we can begin now and work backwards. But I think what I'll say to that is that I feel like I'm just getting started. You know, I've been working for 40 years, and in my family, they live forever, and I'm supposed to be the last one standing. So I'm thinking I've got another 25 years. So really, all I'm thinking about is what I'm going to do next, and I'm never thinking about what I did before I walked in the store.
How do you do that? How do you stay focused
because
like that?
I truly believe if you think you haven't done your best work yet, and you go into the next week with the thought that I can do the best thing I've ever done, or maybe not, that you never age. The vessel ages, but you don't. And I think that artists, if you are always working towards the future, it's the secret of eternal life.
Mm. That's so interesting.
This is like a high tone place to start.
But yeah.
I am always looking ahead. I don't look back. You know, I look back at I think of my older work as old friends, but it's not something I engage with ever. I'm only looking to what I'm going to do next week.
You've had such an incredible career that is so impressive, and I have questions about it, such as designing a postage stamp. Like, come on.
9 postage stamps.
How did you how did you get that gig?
So I was an illustrator. I went to RISD is an illustration major, where I now teach. And illustrators, I started in college illustrating. And I had a really great illustration career for about 15 years. So in those 15 years, my work was probably published close to a billion times. They printed printed 300 million stamp books. So there was a time, probably through the 80s and early 90s, that my work was everywhere. You know, L.L. Bean covers and Yankee magazine covers and postage stamps and the Burger King double cheeseburger box. So it's safe to say that almost everybody engaged with my work at one point. But the thing about being an illustrator is everyone knows your work, but actually no one knows who you are. Mm. So your work is really famous, but you're not.
How do you feel about that?
Great.
Oh.
Because I never went into this for public acclaim. Mm-hmm. I don't really like being the star of the show, but I love my work being the star of the show. So it suited me to have my work front and center, but I didn't have to be front and center.
Mm. What are some other lessons from that time?
Well, I gave my parents a proof set of postage stamps and they used them. And I said, you used the proof set? And they said, yeah, they were stamps. We weren't supposed to use them. I said, no.
They just thought they were free stamps.
Yeah, I gave them like a couple bucks worth of stamps and they used them.
Do you collect stamps?
No, I don't. But I love them. But here's a great thing about stamps. For the same price, you can get stamps that are made by an artist. They're really wonderful. Or you can get like the ugly U.S. postage stamps. So get the nice stamps.
Get the nice stamps.
Support the artist. It doesn't cost you any more money.
100%. We do that. We have a rule. It's actually a Arts Foundation rule that the stamps have to be pretty or interesting or have a message or a social justice meaning.
Yeah, like for the same you can send a social justice message and you can support an artist and you can support the USPS art program, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, get nice stamps.
Get nice stamps. I want to ask you, during that time, like what was rejection like during that time?
Rejection is really awful.
So awful.
And here's the thing about it, is that you can get 100 compliments, but you never remember them. But you always remember that one cutting thing that somebody said to you.
Totally.
It's human nature.
Yeah.
And, you know, you learn to take it and to put up a boundary. But a person that you don't know and maybe don't respect or do respect, but just anybody has the ability to hurt you. And that's true for every artist. Some random person has the ability to really hurt your feelings if you give them the power to hurt your feelings. Mm. So what you learn is to think about an insult or rejection or where it comes from and ask yourself what it is. So there's a professional rejection, which might mean I'm not the right person for this job at the time. And that's normal. And I think that's being out there. And you have to learn to take a professional rejection as not a personal rejection. But there are people who make personal rejections, and it's really not about you. It's more about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned to put up a boundary, and it's part of being out there as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the cost you pay for your work being out there.
It's almost like what you learn in art school, right? The criticism, the critiques, the constant feedback that I feel is so valuable. When I was in school, having those critiques that were sometimes brutal and people would leave in tears.
Every day.
Every day. Every class.
Multiple times per day, somebody would cry and leave class.
Yes. But I feel that it builds such resilience. And
they used to call it character. Now they call it resilience.
It's character and resilience and grit. And it's almost every time it was almost like opening your journal and having people in the class read it sometimes when you would present work.
Oh my God, I have so much to say about this.
Yeah.
So if you go to Harvard,
uh-huh.
Your work isn't read out loud in front of the class every day.
What?
Art school, your work goes up on the wall numbers of times a day for everyone to look at, and you get to judge your work next to everybody, which is really, really difficult. And you always think you're the worst person in the room, always.
Totally. Yeah.
And it's really hard.
It's so hard.
So you do have to build some resilience, but everybody doesn't. You know, the people whose work is really personal, it's really hard not to take it personally. And I remember the most talented kids in the room actually couldn't handle the rejection.
Mm.
And those people did not, the most talented people don't go on to become the most successful artists. It's the people that learn to take rejection, to get better, to look at themselves and to operate as an artist in the world. And sometimes a lot of talent comes with it, a lot of self-doubt.
Mm. Mm. As a professor over at Rhode Island School of Design, what are you seeing the next generation of artists kind of looking like? What are they?
So first of all, I never expected myself to teach. It wasn't a goal. Mm-hmm. And I graduated college and I told myself two things. I'm never going back to RISD and I'm never teaching. So, you know, I'm wrong about a lot of stuff. What is great about teaching is because I teach where I went to school, I'm always faced by my younger self.
Mm.
That I'm dealing with kids that are scared, that are talented, that are putting their work out there, just like me, and who always feel like they fall short. And every artist secretly thinks that they're the worst artist in the whole world. That's really the truth. So you're dealing with kids who are shy and afraid and scared, and it might come off differently as, you know, iron-willed confidence, but everybody's scared, and it's about encouraging people to do what's important to them and to not worry about where it's going to end up or where the commerce is. I don't believe that you can ever chase money with artwork. I think you have to do what you love to do, and then you figure out where to slot it in. But I've never had a success in my life chasing money, and I've never done it.
I see that so much with artists and trying to create what is going to sell versus what they believe in. And it's always such a hard conversation, right? Because you want to make a living.
And everyone's telling you what you have to do.
And everyone's telling you. And it's so hard because you do want to make a living and you know what's going to sell, but then you also feel like crap because you're not doing the work or people aren't, it's not resonating what you're working on.
The most difficult time in my life as an artist was when I was really successful doing something that I didn't believe in. So when I hit the point of being an illustrator where I was doing really well and everyone was giving me a lot of attention and, you know, I was held up as the example. And then when I started to not like my work, it was really difficult.
Interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, I hit the goal. You know, I reached the point where I was turning down a lot of work and I was well known as an illustrator. And when that happens, you have to produce a lot of work quickly. And this is in the days before digital, where it was hard to produce work quickly.
Mm.
So your income is dependent on how quickly you can work. And it's hard to do that. So what you tend to do is to rely on what you already do well. And the next piece you do is not quite as good as the last piece you did. And it's not quite as good as the last piece you did. And you take work you maybe shouldn't have taken. And I started to not like doing my work anymore. I still have nightmares about being an illustrator. I have nightmares that I have something due and I don't even know what it is, but it's due tomorrow.
Ugh, that's the worst.
And I haven't been an illustrator for 20 years, but I still have those nightmares. So I reached the point where I hated what I did.
Yeah.
And I walked away from it. And that was probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
Go on. I want to hear more. Then what did you do?
I knew you would ask that. I failed.
Mm.
And people started to, my career kind of ended and I was doing work that I didn't like. And it took me 20 years and a psychologist's husband to say to me, you didn't fail, you walked away.
Mm.
And what I saw as a failure was actually not that at all, that it was walking away, but it felt so hard and it was so difficult to do and so wrenching that it took me 20 years to realize I walked away from something I had to walk away from. And if I didn't do it, I really would have failed.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of illustrators and a lot of artists that have a success, it's hard to walk away from that thing and it's hard to grow into something else because people want a version of, they want that thing again. Mm-hmm. And I still because my Cape Cod paintings were well known, I still meet people that say, I wish you were doing those Cape Cod paintings still. And I don't know what to say because I appreciate the compliment, but I also say, I'm not that person anymore. And that's why I don't do those paintings.
Will you share the story about the painting and your last painting, the time that you became like a full-on painter? This was like after you walked away from your career.
Ugh. You're asking me like the most like traumatic moment of my entire life.
You know, that's what we do here at the Creative Exchange Podcast.
Okay, so I'll try to do this not in real time because it took like 10 years.
Yeah.
So I was a well-known illustrator, and you can Google me, you can look me up, there's all this stuff. And I walked away from it, and I ran away to the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a place here, but I moved down here full-time, and I decided I was going to paint, that this was the time for me to rediscover myself. And I really didn't have a plan. It sounds like a plan, but it really wasn't a plan. I was running away. I wasn't running towards anything. But I love it here. I love the light. Like, you know, every artist, you're just so inspired by that. You know, here's the trick about the light. What makes the light here is there's a lot of reflected light. So you have direct light, but because there's so much water, you have that reflected blue light. Mm-hmm. And it's what people recognize in the Edward Hoppers. It's that beautiful reflected light. So I came to try to capture it. But looking back, I came here to put myself back together. Mm-hmm. And whenever in my life, since I was a little kid, when things weren't going well, I did artwork. It was always the place I could save myself. So I came down here to save myself. So I started painting, and I got really excited about what I was doing. And I forgot what that felt like.
Mm.
I was so tired of producing artwork for clients that I forgot there was joy in it for me. So I rediscovered that joy. And I painted, and I painted, and I painted. And what I was doing was figuring out my place in the world. And it took about 12, 15 paintings to do. And I realized that I didn't realize till after the fact that I'm not really a painter. I'm not really a painter.
Mm-hmm.
I love it, but I'm not really a painter. And I came down to do something. And I did a series of paintings. And then I happened upon a scene that was very compelling. It was an abandoned cottage in Wellfleet. It was called Donnie's Rest, if you're old enough to remember it. And it was a boarded up cottage. It was all dark under a streetlight. And I looked at it, and it was me. It was compelling, and it was closed up, and there was no way in, and there was no way out. And I knew I had to paint it. So I did the biggest painting that I'd done. It's about a 4-foot gouache.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really good painting. And when I finished it, I knew I was done, that I couldn't top it, that
wow.
I got what I came for.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I walked through the painting, out the back of the cottage, and into the light, and everything was the past. And I was done. So I hit my goal, and I realized that I wasn't really a painter because I would be just doing versions of the same painting over and over. I did my best painting. And then something really weird happened. I thought I was done as an illustrator, and I got contacted by Yankee Magazine out of the blue. And they asked if they could put my work, one of my Cape Cod paintings, actually, that I just did for me, not as an illustration. I did it for me. And they saw it and they asked if they could put it on their summer reading issue. And they put it on their summer reading issue. And it wasn't a big commission. It was, you know, I was used to getting big commissions. It was small money. And I thought, sure, why not? And it went on the summer reading issue when it was a really popular piece. And they gave me another cover. And they were very popular. And they're in, now Yankee Magazine, they have Norman Rockwell covers. I mean, they have an amazing history of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in their book as one of their most popular covers that they've ever done, which I'm so crazily proud of.
It's so cool.
So Yankee Magazine got seen by L.L. Bean. And L.L. Bean contacted me, and that's a really big deal. And they asked if I would do a cover for their catalog. And I did one the spring issue, and I did the summer issue, and I did the fall issue. So I did three in a row, and that was a huge commission. They're seen by everybody. People still have them on their refrigerators. And I was launched back into being an illustrator without thinking about it or planning it.
Yeah.
And I got back into the world of being an illustrator, but this time was completely different. It was doing work that I loved and really spoke to me.
Like by choice.
Right. And I also knew it was going to end. I knew it was finite. So I put everything into it, but I knew that it was going to end. So I got my career back without looking for it. And I will say that it is said that life is lived forward. You must live forward, and it can only be understood backward. It's Kierkegaard.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't make that up. But I will say about my career that looking forward, there's no plan. I did this, I did that, and then I failed at this, and then I tried that. It was just like completely lurching forward to the next thing. But when I look back, it's a perfect sequence.
Mm.
But you don't see that pattern in reverse. So if you ask me to look back, that's the value of looking back, because you see the pattern and the sequence of where you got to where you got. Because looking forward, I will tell you, I didn't have a clue.
I can so relate to what you're saying, and I think a lot of people can. I remember being surrounded by people when I worked in tech for a while, and everybody had a plan. You know, you went to college, you met significant other, you got married, and it was like you were on the program.
Perfect kids and a Land Rover.
Yeah. I could just never understand. I always have felt that I've been flying by the seat of my pants until now. And it's like I look back, just like you're saying, and it is a perfect sequence, because of all the experiences, it's kind of brought me to this point. The successes, the failures, trying different weird jobs and agreeing to do, you know, different things here and there. And I look back at that and I'm like, wow, some of it was really strange to do, but it's an accumulation of everything that I can put into the work now, which makes me really happy.
But if you look at your life now,
yeah,
you couldn't have planned it.
No, there's no plan.
There's no plan.
Do you feel that you were flying by the seat of your pants, or did you feel in control?
I felt in control like a jet pilot feels in control. That you're driving the plane, and I have like complete confidence in when I'm painting and working in artwork.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also flying up, you know, an aluminum tube in the air at, you know, 6,000 miles an hour.
And anything could happen.
And anything could happen. So I think it's like that. I feel like I'm in control of my work, but I'm really not in control of anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the destination. But I have to say something, which I've never said publicly.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful for all the failures.
Mm-hmm.
More so in many ways than success. I never learned anything from success.
Mm-hmm.
I only learned from the failures.
Mm.
So you have to put yourself out there and have them and feel them and feel horrible and think your life is over and, you know, have the crying scene from the movie. And
right.
Then pick yourself up and find something else.
Right. That's interesting. So we talk about, a lot about success here, even just among my colleagues. Sometimes we're like, we'll have a successful night, a successful event, a successful meeting. And you just don't feel, it's like, oh yeah, that's good. But
it's hard to feel a success.
Yeah.
But you feel a failure to the core of your body.
You want to die.
Yeah, you want to die.
It's awful.
It's horrible.
But you're right. If you can just pick yourself back up and keep pushing along, it's going to get better.
Okay, so at RISD, I host a lot of really famous artists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a much higher level than like us here and me, like way, way up from this. And I ask, you know, when they talk about their work and they say that I did this and I did this and I had this success and then this book happened and, you know, so I ask the artists, did you ever have a time where you thought you didn't know what to do?
Mm-hmm.
Where you'd failed,
mm-hmm.
and what happened then.
Mm-hmm.
And that stops every artist cold,
mm-hmm.
and then they start talking. And in that moment, the students can relate to them, because you can't relate to someone who's way up there.
That's right.
You know, and it's some really famous people, but you can really relate to someone who didn't know what to do, who failed and felt alone. And when artists talk about that, they're instantly relatable to a student, because they think, wait a minute, I suck, and I'm alone and I fail and I absolutely don't know what to do and this person is like me.
Right. Totally true.
So it's really important for me when to talk, being an artist is not really talking about success. It's a practice. Mm-hmm. It's a lifetime practice. And people know you for the successes, but they don't know you for all the other times. So it's really important for me to talk about the other times.
Do you feel that that has come with age, that you have the ability to talk about the failures? Or do you, like, you have a humility as you get older? I feel like I talk more about my failures lately than I do my successes.
Welcome to aging. When I was 30, all I could do was, you know, be completely dazzled by my success. And all I could do was talk about myself. And I must have been the worst bore in the entire world.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, I think humility is earned.
Yeah.
And I really didn't earn my success. I mean, I was good at what I did. I was the right guy at the right time.
Do you think you were lucky?
Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky and I was privileged. So, I mean, I went to a great art school. Mm-hmm. I could, you know, I was able to afford that. I had parents that supported my dream. Mm-hmm. So I had, I mean, I came in on the third floor, honestly, and I didn't realize that at the time. I thought, well, I'm, you know, I deserve this. And looking back, I don't think that at all. I think I was lucky and I worked hard and it was really nice, but I don't accept the word deserve. I accept the word lucky and I accept that I worked hard. And this is great, but when people say you deserve it, I can't accept that because there's so many people who deserve so much that don't get it. Mm. So, yeah, lucky.
Yeah. You and I did, so you and I met and have become fast friends.
We did. We became instant friends.
And so it's really, it's like so hard to interview a friend, but I'm having so much fun because I know some things about you that other people don't, I think. But one of the things that we did together that was really fun was you and I did a TEDx Provincetown talk.
It was so fun.
It was so hard.
It was so hard.
And I couldn't have done it without you.
We couldn't have done it without you. So it was... You know, we made fast friends. And one of the things that aging is good about age is that you learn to trust people more. Mm-hmm. And you learn to, like, follow your instinct on people. Mm-hmm. You know, when I fell in love with you first day. Mm. And we became our supporters.
Yes.
And people don't think that artists and people in the arts support each other as much as they do, but they really do. Mm-hmm. So our talks were completely different, but we listened to each other's talks and we completely supported each other. And we, like, joked and laughed and made fun of them. And... I couldn't have done it without you.
No, same. And it was about 6 months of preparation.
Oh my God. You have no idea how hard a 10-minute talk is. Like, I recorded and I listened to it in the car, like, every day for, like, 6 months.
I know.
And then here's the worst part about it. So this is the thing nobody knows. Is I recorded the, you know, I record the talk and I memorized it, which is really hard because
totally
you memorize
hard.
It and you do and you forget like whole things.
Yeah.
And then just before the talk, a week before, I had help from a coach, a theatrical coach, Steve Mailer. And he's a big deal coach. He's, you know, the head of the Cumble Shakespeare Company. And I performed my talk to him and I was so proud of myself. And he looked at me, he said, "It sounds like a really nice memorized speech."
Yeah, great advice, right? Great feedback.
I was crushed. I was crushed. I said, oh,
I remember
my God,
this.
It's a week before. What am I going to do? And he sat with me. He worked with me for like three or 4 hours, probably more. We only had one day together, half a day. And he taught me how to take apart a line and to emphasize the words that matter. And I realized, oh, this is what newscasters and people on TV do and actors do. So he taught me how to be an actor in 3 hours, which, you know, I'm not a good actor. I'm still not good at it. But he helped me deliver something that had more heart and conviction than it ever would have. So I'm really grateful for my friends.
Yeah. You did such
for
a good
you,
job.
For you, for Steve, for my husband, for everybody. It's like we all supported each other and that's what life is.
Yeah. I mean, we could have given each other's TED Talks by the end of it.
Oh, yeah. I said, I told Rick, I said, if you die just before the talk, I can get up and do it.
Or I will.
Yeah.
It was such a, it filled, sometimes in this job as an administrator, I don't get a lot of creative outlets, but this podcast is a great outlet. And the TEDx talk, when I think back to it, I'm like, wow, that was a really special time. And having the time to plan it, I mean, it took probably 4 months to come up with a concept, and then it's 2 months of practicing the lines and refining.
And you have like 2 hours worth of material that you have to cut down to 10 minutes.
Yes.
It's so hard. It's like, I think it's the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah. How did you come up with your topic? Tell us your topic first. Do you remember it?
It was about creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about where it comes from. I can't even remember at this point. It seems like it's kind of a dream that it all happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about the place that we live and the place that we dream.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where creativity comes from, that it's built by the imagination. And you go to this place and then you bring it back home.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think everybody's creative, but we forget. And some of the greatest feedback I had is people saying to me, like when you're kids, you're naturally creative. And I talk about that in the talk. And adults tamp you down. You know, they say, mm-hmm. just pay attention and, you know, follow your studies and go to Stanford, marry well.
But, get on the program.
Get on the program. But creative people aren't like that.
No.
But I think most people give it up. And the most touching comments I got are people saying to me, you made me remember what that was like. And that you said that I can have that back. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that.
Mm. Somewhat of a reinvention?
I think life is a continual reinvention. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think it's about being present. And I think artists have to do that. It's one of the great gifts of being an artist. Listen, it's a hard life being an artist, but you get some great stuff. You meet the best people and you get to be present to a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being present and having learned from failure, mm-hmm. that if I'm bored, my work is going to be boring and I'm going to be boring. So I can't afford to be bored. And that means I have to always be looking for stimulus, you know, visual stimulus, and it comes from everywhere. But it's unexpected. You know, you meet someone somewhere, or you go someplace, and we met, and you just get this constant excitement and stimulation,
mm-hmm.
Which is why I feel like a kid. I don't look like a kid, but this is a podcast, so you can imagine me as, you know,
you're totally,
20.
You're like 20.
Right. I'm like 20. Well, I'm 67. And this past year was one of the most difficult years, but also one of the best years I've ever had. So it was really the best year of my life.
Mm.
So maybe like 68 will be better, or maybe I'll have a couple of years and then 70 will be amazing. So I'm really excited about what's going to happen, but I know what it takes. I'm going to have to be present and awake and alive and looking for the next thing.
How do you take care of yourself to do that?
Well, everyone in my family lives forever, even if they don't take care of themselves. So
I know, you've
lucky.
Mentioned that. You're lucky, but like...
I take really good care of myself. I've never smoked a cigarette. I exercise a lot. I eat well. And I take really good care of myself.
Yeah.
And that's important because I need myself to function and all my facilities, and I need to be awake and alive. So I didn't when I was young. You know, I did everything stupid like everybody else. But
yeah.
I really take care of myself now. When you're my age, you have to.
Yeah, yeah. And you look it. You're so healthy.
And people are imagining how good I look.
You look so handsome.
And you are so cute.
Thank you. Yeah.
We got to meet and mm-hmm. we became friends and here we are today. And
I know.
Life has all this serendipity.
Completely.
But it doesn't happen if you are just at home scrolling on your phone.
Nope.
And I am really lucky that I'm the last generation that grew up pre-digital.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go out. I had to look for things. I go to museums. I had to have experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me sad that people's experiences now are mostly on the phone. But I can't say it's better or worse. It's just the way it is.
Mm.
So in my generation, we had to convert from being analog to digital.
Mm.
And I used to think it was a drawback that I was behind, but now I realize, oh my God, I was so lucky to have that life before social media ruined it.
I totally agree.
And I think, you know, see my students, I think social media is ruining their lives.
I totally agree. I have so many mixed feelings about, you know, the accessibility to it and what it's doing and what it's marketing into my kids' brains.
It's much worse for girls because, yeah, you know, girls who already are less confident, mm-hmm, men get confidence as a gift, gift wrap packages, but women have to earn it. Yeah. And I think the social media is just brutal to women because they're always comparing themselves to a fictional version of something that they're not as good as. So I say to my students, I say to them, you are the people that everyone else is comparing themselves to. And you're comparing yourself to somebody else and thinking you're falling short. Mm-hmm. I said, you know this stuff is fake. Why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. So I'm really sad about it.
Yeah.
You know, this great opportunity is just a great opportunity for people to feel worse about themselves all the time.
All the time. How do you feel about AI?
It's too soon to know. You know, I think ChatGPT is amazing. Mm-hmm. I asked it some really complicated questions about the metaverse and creativity, and it was like, it gave me the best answers.
It could have written our TED Talks.
It could have. Yeah, it probably is writing TED Talks right now. Hi, I want to write a TED Talk on, and ChatGPT will give you a great one. AI is too new to say.
Yeah.
My entrepreneurial genius friends say that it's changing the world and you have to like embrace it and own it as a tool. And interestingly, I found it at RISD because I've been on sabbatical. So the whole AI thing happened during my sabbatical. And I said, what am I coming back to? Mm. And I was told that the students think it's really interesting as a research tool to generate ideas and interest, but they don't feel it's the finished product is alive or representative of what it is they really want to do. And I was so happy to hear that.
That makes sense to me, especially from a creative community.
So I'm going to think of it as a tool, mm-hmm, as an amazing tool, maybe the best tool that's ever happened, mm-hmm, and see what happens. I know it's a big deal at work and, you know, it's transforming life. And it's too soon for me to say whether that's for the better or the worse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm watching too. It seems very, I was right in the thick of the, you know, the web internet coming on. You know, I worked in tech in San Francisco in 2000 and we were never afraid of technology. Like there was no fear. It was like a fearless time until it ended.
Until it was too late.
Abruptly.
Right.
And we all went from executives to, you know, church secretary. But so it is interesting. Some part of me is excited about learning more, and part of me is like, whoa, how is this going to impact my kids?
Right. Well, when I went from being a painter to working in Photoshop, you know, everyone said you're cheating. You know, there's always, everyone thinks that artists are cheating.
Right.
You know, I think that like when the first artist left the cave, someone said you're cheating.
Yeah.
But I don't know, the metaphor that I use is, that I'm thinking about a lot is that I see a lot of these beautiful AI fashion shoots and stuff, and everyone looks amazing, but everyone looks dead. It looks like zombie world, mm-hmm, because they haven't figured out how to like build a soul into AI yet, but they will.
Yeah.
And I think of it as like Pygmalion and Galatea. Mm-hmm. Pygmalion sculpted the most beautiful woman alive in marble, and he begged for her to be brought to life. And she came to life, his dream come true, but she wasn't given a soul. So he was stuck with this beautiful thing that he sculpted that actually had no soul. And I think that's AI in some ways.
Oh, that's such a good reference.
And, you know, I'm picturing my tombstone now and it says, didn't believe in AI.
Died early. okay, I have one last question.
Yeah.
And this is from our time doing TED and your reference to The Wizard of Oz. Who would you pick to be you in The Wizard of Oz? What character would you be?
Oh, that's easy. We're all Dorothy. No one's the Wicked Witch. I spend way too much time thinking about The Wizard of Oz for someone my age. But the great thing about it is that, and what I say in the talk is that, what if Kansas was real and Oz was also real? And I think that Oz represents the imagination. You know, when Dorothy went through all the scary stuff to get to this place, that she decided to come home because there was no place like home. But my life changed when I read the book and I realized that actually Oz wasn't a dream. It was real. And that she left, but she went back. And that to me was like, my whole life suddenly made sense. Because I could never understand why she wanted to leave that place to return to depressed Kansas, right. You know, where she had no purchase, no anything in her life.
Yeah,
she was the Queen of Oz, and she left, but she went back. So that's the great thing. But I think we all have an incredible imagination. We just maybe forgot it. And if you are thinking about that you want to be creative again, it's just letting yourself daydream and have an imagination again. You have it. It was given to you. It's not talent. It's just it's a gift. And just let your imagination, don't stop it from where it wants to go. Let it happen and don't think, well, it's, you know, it's the wrong place. It's the wrong something. What am I going to do with this? How am I going to sell it? It's just that's all ways that you just stop yourself from being alive. And you will discover something, your creative self. I promise.
I love that. That's a perfect ending to this conversation. Are we going to spend Thanksgiving together again this year?
That would be great.
Okay. Thank you for being here.
Oh, I love you to death.
I love you too. Thanks for joining us.
Hosted by Arts Foundation's Executive Director, Julie Wake, the series is an ode to the artistic process and its unique manifestation on Cape Cod and beyond. Thanks for listening.